KP Ready with Shad Adventures, and today on our fireside chat, I've got Connor Sen, who's a friend and local Atlantan, who additionally is a columnist from Bloomberg, and I would say very active on the Twitters. So get a lot of good economic data. So we thought it would be great to kick off 2022 just to have some kind of conversations about how you're, what you're seeing data-wise and how you're thinking about the world. But to kick off, like, maybe give everybody a little bit of background so they can get some context about kind of where you've been and where you're going.
Sure. So my college background was in economics and computer science. I went to a small school in Southern California called Harvey Mudd. From there, I did a couple different things in the Bay Area. I worked for eBay for a year, and then I worked for a big hedge fund in San Francisco for 4 years, where I did sort of credit derivative stuff, all the mortgage meltdown. I was involved with that, risk management, things like that. After surviving that, I decided I kind of wanted to get away from that and start over. So I moved to Atlanta, where I had a couple friends. I worked for Cabbage for 18 months, for those of you familiar with that company. And then in 2012, I went out on my own and I started an investment company, and I started writing for Bloomberg about 5 years ago.
Okay, very cool. So I thought we'd just hit some of the topics that we keep hearing over and over and just keep getting bombarded in our news feeds and everywhere else. So I think we talked about it last night, just like topic wise. So let's talk about this thing called the Great Resignation, which is super interesting because you hear the noise, but I don't know that I've had that many in our world of startups and mid-sized companies. I don't know that we've had that much like, hey, can't find people. Or even with a lot of our LPs, which are large corporates, haven't come to me and said, oh my God, it's impossible to just find anyone. So what should we make of this Great Resignation topic?
It's interesting because the topic is being talked about in our white collar worlds, but the dynamic is really much more of a blue collar thing. So you're seeing it in restaurants and hotels and hospitality, and then additionally manufacturing and warehousing and driving and those sorts of jobs, but really haven't seen it as much in sort of your IT, finance, real estate type jobs. So it's a real thing if you run fast food companies or you need to hire a driver to deliver your goods. But it's not really a thing, at least so far in the aggregate, in the data, if you're hiring developers or finance people like that.
I mean, that job market's already been habitually tight, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Developers.
I mean, I think one dynamic is we do know due to the pandemic that about 1 or 2 million baby boomers retired more than you'd expect just from trend. And so that is a lot of seats and of people in their 50s and 60s that need to be filled. And so maybe they're not being filled by 30-year-olds, but it's like if you hire a 45-year-old to take the C-suite job, then you hire a 35-year-old to take his job, and so on and so forth. And so there's a lot of backfilling that's going on right now, I think.
I've talked to several CEOs. I talked to probably a dozen CEOs at the end of the year, and they were talking about bonuses and comp plans for next year. And so many of them were saying, hey, I'm going to do a spot bonus because I can't take away a raise.
Right.
And I'm not sure that where we're at is really a sustainable thing, that if I give someone a 15% raise for next year, that I'm not going to be looking at 2023 saying, hey, I'm out of whack on my comp, so I'm just going to do a spot bonus for the year. When we talk about the Great Resignation and wage increases, it seems like the executives that have been through lots of cycles are being super pragmatic, and they're saying, look, I'm not going to let people leave. I'm a spot bonus them. And I think even Apple announced something that they've never done, has been hiring bonuses.
So one sort of way to connect back to that great resignation idea is that in an industry, like if you're running fast food or a hotel or things like that, your line cooks and the people who take out the trash, they're getting huge raises because that minimum wage that's really being in the market is closer to $15 an hour. But that assistant manager who's maybe making 20 all of a sudden is feeling like, what the heck? Like, I have to pay 15 to hire somebody to take out the trash. I'm only making 20. And so I think this year is going to be catching those people up. And so maybe in white collar firms, you have the same idea where your entry level hires are getting pretty big raises. And now the management's saying, wait, like, it's my turn. Yeah. And so I think to your point, it's, will spot raises do the trick, or spot bonuses, or is it raises? And I think that's a question for management heading into this year.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, not to get into politics, but like last year, the election cycle about like you know, livable wage. And like the government needs to intervene. And then capital markets and demand, and Amazon says, hey, we're going to pay everybody $20 an hour and pay for their college. And that's awesome. And it's also, you know, government didn't intervene. It was kind of a natural motion, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, back in April or so, there was talk about Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, maybe getting on board with $11 an hour for a national minimum wage. And that got dropped. And now it's like, I think if you're not paying 11, you're just not doing a very good, you're probably running a bad business.
Yeah.
And that you don't, even on Twitter, where people are always talking about overthrowing capitalism, you don't really hear much about raising the minimum wage anymore. It's sort of understood that that's not really an issue in this labor market, at least for the time being.
Yeah, I'm gonna kind of take some questions as people pop in, because it's, you know, people are generally pretty shy. So when they actually ask a question, I'm like, okay, let's not put them off. So one of the things is the whole work from home, which I think for the white collar world, it's like finally everybody gets it. You know, it's not new news. But what about like the whole idea of remote and getting back to the office? And I think we've talked about it. I spend half my time up in Asheville, North Carolina, and I keep running into people from New York and Chicago that have moved there. And they're like, look, you know, I'm making Chicago wages living in Asheville. This is a pretty good deal. And nobody's asked me to give any money back. So, because I think when it, you know, back to wages, right, a lot of it for white collars, like what do I have left? Right. Maybe I didn't get a raise, but like I have more disposable income because I'm living in a cheaper market.
Yeah. So something interesting was I wrote a column or two about this last summer, and then Bloomberg HR reached out to me to, you know, because they're actually trying to hire and they just wanted to know what I thought. And they said that they didn't really have a firm policy, Bloomberg LP, in terms of remote. And what they noticed is that they were losing people for remote jobs, and they were gaining people who maybe had a stricter sort of work schedule at their existing employer. And there's almost like a market being formed of, you know, you might think like, well, this is our policy, but then you're going to gain or lose people as a function of that. And so I think that this is going to be much more of a market force dynamic at the end of the day, unless you're a Goldman Sachs or a, you know, a really top tier employer where you can just do whatever you want. If you're just, you know, you're running a company, you're ultimately, you know, trying to hire in a competitive market. And if you can't offer people what somebody else will, they're going to go somewhere else. And I think there are a couple angles here in terms of, if you ran a company in 2019, you have a normal in mind of, all right, well, we have an office. This is how we did things. Should we be in the office 5 days a week or 2 days? You're trying to base off of what you had before. But if you're starting a company today, you're not anchored to anything. And so I think an interesting question is, you know, the Facebook or Uber that's being started today, what is their work life schedule going to be like? And, you know, what's the next $100 billion company that's being built? What are they going to do? And I think that we just don't know yet.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things everybody's talking about, return to the office and office leases. Well, not many people's leases have been up for renewal. You know, there's a little bit, well, I have a lease, and I have furniture and I've got coffee machines, whatever, right? Conference rooms. We might as well try to go back in. But I think it'll be interesting to see the data on lease renewals, because all of a sudden, if I say, well, I'm going to cut back my space or not renew at all.
And I think you could still, I don't think it's realistic, but you can kind of talk yourself into, we're not post-pandemic yet, in terms of like from a, you know, office business dynamic of, well, we had Delta variant and then we had Omicron and we're winter. But by March or April, like we're really going to be back to normal. And so even though that's now 2 years after the initial event, there's still, I think, some people are holding out hope that, yeah, we'll get back there. It's just going to take a little longer than we thought. And I don't think it's going to happen. I think like your class A, great amenity type office buildings and neighborhoods are going to do fine. But if you had kind of a marginal building in a marginal neighborhood, you probably need to do some work and haven't really acknowledged that yet.
Yeah. I was talking to a CEO that said that they're going to minimize their space and turn them into almost like conference coffee shop kind of vibe, like collaboration centers. And they're going to take all their savings and do like quarterly get-togethers to keep people, kind of keep that social aspect. And we're just going to do quarterly and we'll move it around the country where our, you know, concentrated area offices are. And the money that we'll be saving on office space and staff and everything that goes into running an office, we're still making out better, which I thought was kind of an interesting idea that I think all of us agree that the human connection and all that's important, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we all want to sit through an hour of traffic. And
yeah, and I think the question is how much socializing is really valuable? Like, we've both probably had jobs where we sat in offices 40 hours a week, and it's, you say hi to people at the water cooler, but like, you know, you get fired or you quit, and it's like you never think about that person ever again. And so it's how much of your actual coworkers matter to your productivity and happiness, and how much of that can we recreate in other ways, or, you know, 3 hours a week or whatever. And so I think we kind of, you know, there's a little bit of rose colored glasses about how that is for a lot of people.
Yeah. And I also think like the computing power aspect of cloud and what we can, you know, it used to be, you know, oh, I have to VPN into the office and oh my God, it's so terrible and it drops and blah, blah, blah. And I need to really be on my desktop in the office to get work done. And like, it's like now, like we all have bandwidth and we have cloud computing and there's no real infrastructure benefit to being in the office. It is purely kind of social connection.
Yeah, I think so. And maybe a party once a week, once a month, once a quarter is enough to get that just kind of camaraderie rather than 8 hours a day, 5 days a week.
Yeah, a friend of mine said, I don't actually miss the monthly everybody huddle into the conference room to celebrate the January birthdays.
Yeah, those were kind of painful a lot of the times. Like, all right, yeah, John has a birthday. Who's John?
Yeah, it's like, I just work with these people. I don't like them. Right. I don't dislike them, but I don't like, you know.
I am sympathetic if you're 25. Like, you probably are missing out on something. But, you know, at the end of the day, we haven't really, I mean, you and I are both, have survived this labor force for 15 or 20 years. We've never really cared about young people. We might say we do, but we really don't.
No, I mean, the current generation never really cares about the next generation. We just like to complain.
Yeah.
So what, you know, back to like the remote work and work from, you know, there was something I think you posted or it was floating around about the migration of household, like migration of people away from the coasts to everywhere else. And I forgot, you might know the number, like I think Atlanta added, forgot how many residents.
Yeah, I don't remember the number, but that's
50,000 almost.
Yeah, they're kind of two different dynamics. One is that you've had a migration from the urban cores into the outlying suburbs. So in the Bay Area, like the East Bay suburbs really booms, but so did Tahoe and Boise and Austin. And so, you know, it's not one or the other. It's kind of both depending on your circumstances.
Yeah. And what do you think, you know, I want to move a little bit to the other hot topic, inflation. Mm-hmm. And everybody's, you know, last year it was transitory. And now everybody's like, I think it's here. And I'm such a nerd. Like I track the cost of my dog's dog food. Like I like it's a little bit not healthy, but I've seen it increase. And then we talk about inflation, not just in terms of price. But, you know, you go stay in a hotel, it's 30% more for a room. They're not cleaning your room. Like you're paying more and getting less service. So a lot of that getting less piece, what's the old adage about cereal boxes? The box stays the same, but the amount in it keeps.
Right.
So what are you seeing? I mean, how are you thinking about like, it feels like everybody's agreed it's not transitory.
Maybe. Yeah, I think, you know, there was hope in the spring when it was like, all right, used car prices and hotel rooms and used like maybe it's just these few factors that are pandemic related. And if we can just get past this and that normalizes, then it's fine. But we haven't really seen that yet. And in fact, used car prices are still going higher. And it's like, we keep talking about the semiconductor issue being fixed and it's not fixed. So it's, I think we should be a little more humble about when that's going to all sort out. You know, I think the way they calculated inflation last year was say 6-7%. I think that's not realistic because again, there are these used car factors going on, but I think we're probably at a pace of more like 3-4 at least. And that probably cools off somewhat this year, but you know, the 2 is the Fed's target. I don't think we're gonna get to 2. But the other part of that is, you know, like in the 2000s when gas prices were really high, $4 a gallon, that was inflationary. But in a way it's like, if you're spending more money on gas, you have less money to spend on everything else. And so if you said to me, if gas prices went to 0 tomorrow, like that's less inflation sort of, but then you'd also have more money to spend on everything else. And so to the extent that a lot of these weird pandemic supply bottlenecks get fixed, I think that could mean more money to spend on vacations and housing and things like that. So in the aggregate, I think it could be some more interesting shifts this year. And it's not just about lower inflation. It's like, all right, we can spend more on the things we want to spend more on and not just this thing we can't get on a boat from China.
Yeah, and I do think I can only talk about my own personal buying behavior. I've been trying to buy a sofa for the last year and a half. Yeah. And because I can't get it fast enough, and like I'm going to order now, give you half the money, and I'll see it in 6 months. That's just not fulfilling enough. I want it so next week, right?
My sister works for Wayfair. And so I've been talking to her about what she's been seeing. And the freight issue is huge for them, because a lot of times furniture is very big and bulky, but not that expensive. And it might cost more to ship it from China to the US than they would typically sell it for. Mm-hmm. And that just means like either you have to massively raise the price, or you just don't sell the item because it doesn't make sense for you.
Yeah. And in my case, it's like, I'd rather just not have it than, I'd rather not spend the money than wait 6 months. Like, that's insane, whatever.
We were looking at a new front door, and we were given like 6 months to get it. It's like, no, we'll just keep the door. It's fine.
Right. Inflation doesn't affect you if you don't actually spend any money.
Yeah. But I mean, it is kind of deferred consumption in a way, because, maybe you will buy that furniture if you can get it. And so it's, you buy it the latter half of this year.
Yeah. So we got a couple more comments. Comment questions. we'll talk about Web3 in a second. I'm already on Web4.
I'm gonna listen to you about that. Yeah.
We actually had a really good talk last month with our friend Marty, who's kind of one of these Web3 NFT. He was part of the Constitution DAO. So if you really want to know about that, I think it's live on YouTube, which is I would say Marty was probably more informed around that than anything me.
I feel like the most optimistic thing I have to say about Web3 is a lot of smart people and a lot of money is trying to make something happen. And I guess you shouldn't doubt that they'll make something happen.
Yeah. And I think as a guy that, did well during the .com and survived the .bomb, there is a cycling of this stuff that happens. There was Webvan, which maybe some people don't remember, it's like Webvan, and it was like crazy. I'm going to order groceries off my computer. I mean, this is insane.
Right.
And it blew up. And then, the near-term conclusion was, grocery delivery will never work. Right. That was the near-term conclusion, mm-hmm. And then mobility happens and things happen. And then all of a sudden we're good with it. It's like, and I think some of the Web3 stuff, it might iterate and there will be some collateral damage and people will lose money and people will make money and it will cycle back through. It's kind of the
right.
So one thing, I kind of mentor younger folks and we're talking about inflation and I was like, it sucks to be a renter. Because if you look at being young and the bulk of your expense being your living expenses, the one thing that's great about a mortgage, whether you think your property's appreciating or not, from just a pure expense perspective, super predictable. I know exactly what I'm paying for the next 20 years or 30 years. Whereas if I'm renting, the minute the lease comes up, who knows? So how do you think about like real estate price increases? Is it increasing? Is it inflationary? There was a bunch of data that came out this morning that said, hey, there's just no supply. There's a ton of demand and there's just no supply, which is always kind of interesting to see that. And it takes a minute. We're talking about supply chain issues. Well, supply chain does affect construction, does affect home builders, and they can't deliver overnight. So how are you thinking about real estate appreciation and kind of scarcity of product versus kind of just this demand cycle we're in?
Yeah, so I think there's a long answer to this. I think the short answer is, if you think home prices this year are going to go up 8 to 10%, which is my opinion and the opinion of like the John Burns Real Estate Company, which I respect a lot, and mortgage rates are 3%, why would you sell something that you can finance at 3% that's going to go up in price 8 to 10%? And then that feeds into the low inventory piece. Incomes are growing very strongly. We know that the bulk of millennials are moving into their home buying years and baby boomers aren't really leaving or selling their houses yet. So I don't know what makes this gets fixed if you can't deliver enough homes to the market because supply chains are all backed up. Like there's a house being built in my street that they're going to sell for 1.4 million. And they started building it in the summer and it's still not built yet. Like I watch it every day or every week and it's like, they'll frame it and then they're waiting for, the windows to come in and the windows take 2 or 3 weeks. And then they put the windows in And then they wait again because the doors need to come in, and it's like stop and start. And then the whole process takes 6 or 9 months. And if this is what it takes to build a $1.4 million house in Atlanta, how do we have any hope of building enough homes to meet the demand?
Yeah. No, and I think too is, you know, I think we still all are super interested in being in city centers, even though, you know, work from home and all that, you know, we live in closer into the city. You know, I'm not saying, oh, wow, I can't find anything around here, I'm going to move to Woods, like 45 minutes away. I still have zero interest in that, even if I am working from home. Mm-hmm. So I think to your point is, you know, if it's going to take forever and there's still a lot of demand and people are doing it, then, you know, it's going to keep going on. What do you think about some of the, you know, the suburbs and real estate prices in the suburbs? I really struggle with, you know, the idea that there's these 500 home subdivisions and that there's supply issues and, you know, that they're escalating too. I mean, it makes sense that city centers, it's a scarcity of product, but, you know, not to pick on Pulte, but Pulte shows up and does 500 homes. Do you have any insights on, is that still moving in price? So
the suburban model that's going to be the winner, and that, you know, you've seen it, and you and I might not want to live in Woodstock, but a lot of people do. So it's, you know, your Woodstock, Duluth, these like suburban town centers where you build this kind of walkable area that you have to drive to. And then, you know, the homes kind of are built around that. And that's really what I think the model is going to be and what gets built, especially in this work from home world where, all right, you live in your house out there and then you know, maybe go to the town center for a meeting or for coffee during midday. And then if you really have to go into the city for a big meeting, you can do that.
Yeah. So our friend Trolls Adrian, formerly Atlanta, and then I think it was in Portland, and now we're Sacramento, I think.
Yeah.
See, Trolls, we're tracking you. We know where you're at. He's like, I'm interested in your thoughts on the longer term future of the housing market. Will the exit of the boomers, automation and construction and reduced immigration eventually create some room down the road?
So I think the thing with baby boomers is that, like, all right, if you've got an 85-year-old in Pasadena who's exiting a house, like, you can fill that spot really quickly. But if you have a, you know, 85-year-old leaving a house in suburban Ohio, a house that hasn't been touched in 30 years, that doesn't really help you if people want to live in Nashville and Austin. And so I think there's a big mismatch issue that's coming. And even in Atlanta, like, Atlanta's got great demographics, but, you know, the types of houses that 80-year-olds exit are not really desirable to a 30-year-old without a lot of work being done. And so I think it's not just about, you know, exiting a unit, filling it in. It's really, you've got to do a lot of work to make it livable and desirable to that next generation.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too. I think a lot of boomers are realizing retiring doesn't mean I'm old and dead. Yeah. And they're moving to city centers and they want to move. You know, when I was down at Georgia Tech, it was amazing how many people were moving around a college campus because they loved the energy and the restaurants. And they're like, hey, we're empty nesters now. I don't want a yard. I love the idea of an elevator. I love the idea of, you know, shared resources and going out to eat every night. So it seems like some of the boomers don't even want the houses that they're selling.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, for so long you've had the Florida, Arizona retirement home community, and it's that works for a certain kind of buyer, but for your, maybe, you know, your younger or the next generation that's better educated and has different lifestyle preferences, they might not want to go to the villages. And so they're trying to create a more, maybe it's an Asheville type model, but maybe not in Nashville, North Carolina. To your point, like, you kind of sprinkle it in here and there throughout metro areas, and it's not just everyone go to Florida.
Yeah. It is also interesting, you know, one thing I think, I don't know if it's been talked about or I haven't seen a ton of data focused on it, the idea of the second home. I bought mine in the middle of the pandemic. I always said I would never have a second home because I travel so much, I would never get to it. I didn't want a second set of garbage cans to deal with. I didn't want to deal with, you know, just the maintenance of two properties. It was just a pain. And I wanted variability in where I, you know, hang out. And I went out and, you know, the thing that I said I'd never do, I went out and did. And I've had a lot of friends go off and, you know, buy that second home, which pulls from inventory again.
Yeah. Something I've been thinking about is that when your generation, you're like a half generation ahead of me, was my age, like, the Great Recession had just happened. a lot of people were pretty, you know, their 401ks had gotten decimated, their home equity was gone, and they were just trying to keep their job and rebuild their home equity. And so there wasn't a lot of demand for, you know, an additional home or that sort of thing, especially after what had happened. But with people my age and younger, if you bought a house anytime in the last 10 years, it's worked out really well for you. Your 401k is at an all-time high. You're getting a raise at work. And so you're 40 and you're looking around and saying, I've got quite a bit of money and mortgage rates are still really low. So it's, I think people are in much more of an attitude to buy that second property, spend more money on experiences because they're just flush with cash in a way they didn't expect they'd be 10 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen it in our venture firm. The number of first time, I've never invested in a venture fund conversations we're having and are at a high because people are saying, hey, I feel like I'm pretty deep in the market. I bought some Bitcoin because someone told me to buy some Bitcoin and I maybe bought an NFT and, you know, I'm thinking about another, but they still have, there's still cash left over, right? It's like, and I still have cash. And I'm not going to put it in the bank account. Like there's just, you know, and which is a good segue. I mean, I think into the rising interest rate environment, right? I mean, even if we have rising rates, it's not happening overnight. Like I'm still not going to get a lot of yield out of my money market anytime soon.
Yeah. Like markets right now don't expect interest rates to go over 2%. And you could say they're wrong, but like we've been doing this for decades of like, all right, rates are going to go up, rates are going to go up. And they really haven't. And I think they could go above 2%, but it's going to require a lot more inflation than the people who follow markets all day long currently expect. And I think above, say, 3%, you'd really start to hit housing. And so it's, I don't think that should be your base case. It could happen, but we've just been doing, you know, for 40 years, people have been calling this and it's, we saw last year, we had massive inflation and interest rates are still below 2%. So it's, I think to your point, like people are going to put their money in other things rather than just waiting on interest rates to go up.
Right. I mean, because even if interest rates go, I mean, how's it going to affect your money? I mean, the yield, it's still not going to be
right.
It's interesting.
Like if it was 3% and you have like a few hundred grand in the market, it's like, I don't want to do that. Like, it's not interesting.
Right. Have you done much in blockchain? I mean, in Bitcoin or?
No, I mean, because I manage money for clients, I was always like, I don't want to break the seal. And then it's like, if regulators come in, then I'm a crypto guy. And I'm like, I'm just going to stay out of that. Like I said, it's my Web3 ideas. A lot of smart people are putting a lot of money into this and I should respect that, but I'm still waiting for it to be relevant to what I do every day, which I'm not dismissive, but it hasn't been relevant to my day-to-day yet.
Yeah. No, I think at the end of the day, like same argument with NFTs, however you want to look at NFTs, you know, whether you think it's the equivalent of a Pokemon card, which has, you know, it's a piece of cardboard, has no real value either, or right. a beanie baby, right? It has no actual value, but they trade. You know, if there's someone willing to pay more for something you own, and you can actually own it, which I think is the whole point of NFTs, is that it's a digital, that you own it, so to speak. You know, who am I to? My kids are into collecting shoes, and I don't get it. You know, I'm like, why won't you wear the shoes? And they're like, what that? It's like,
I keep waiting for somebody to have a use case for me that would be useful. And not just me, but like my wife, why would she want to do any of this stuff? And so maybe they'll prove me wrong, but it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. I do think, and we talked last month with Marty about, I'm bullish because I think for the creator economy to create something and keep getting paid, mm-hmm. and not having to wait till you die for your creations to be worth something. I think that's pretty fascinating that there's like this annuity associated with it. Let me see if there's sit on the questions. What are you, you know, I feel like I spend so much of my day like dealing with listening to the economic data and the employment data, and it's just like everything, there's a bombarding of data that, you know, I'm sure you read and consume. And if you had to give people on the call advice, right? Cause I think I still watch CNBC. My kids are like, Dad, nobody watches CNBC anymore. I'm like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
if you look at like journalism, like even what's happened with like Substack and people, you know, you have people leaving. Are there some favorites that you're watching, reading, listening?
For just anything or
economic data?
I mean, I think for like the main economic data, you can really just read your Wall Street Journal, whatever your favorite source is. Like people, mainstream media does a really good job with just crunching the numbers. I think electric vehicles have become a big interest of mine over the past year. And not like, cause I'm a Tesla fanboy, but like, I think it's the whole transition that we're going to go through over the next 10 or 15 years. There's so many layers to it. And it's like, you know, from putting factories in Georgia and maybe not in Michigan. And what does that mean for supply chains and service centers and real estate and utilities? There's so many layers to it that I think it's going to ripple through the economy in so many different ways and trying to understand that better. Yeah. So like Nat Bullard is a colleague at Bloomberg Opinion. And so he's somebody I've come to talk to more and more to help me understand what's going on there. And I think the next couple of years in particular are going to be a pretty big inflection point in the US.
Yeah. I got really excited about EV. So I went to Rivian and I went to Ford and it's like waitlist. So I had the same issue I have with Sophie.
Right.
Like you would have got me. You would have got me if I could have hit pay now, you would have got me.
I'm on the Rivian waitlist and it's second half of 2023 is what they tell me. Right. So maybe it's 2024. I don't know.
It's not as exciting. So it's like
it's like the future is back ordered, right? That's how it feels like right now.
Yeah. So David Wiltz, who's one of the CEOs of Digital Master Plan in our incubator, he asked, can we talk about equity and wealth divide, especially around homeownership? Most affordable housing is rental. It's hard to say what's the future.
I like being an optimist. I think the capitalism is not going to build affordable housing for affordable buyers to buy anymore. And I think that's for a couple of reasons. One is that there's not enough land and labor to do it affordably. And then institutionally, like your BlackRocks and so on, they want to build the rent. And so they say, like, we think demographics are strong, rent growth is strong. We would rather buy the homes, rent them out, maybe for 5 or 10 years and then sell them. But I think the days of, you know, a household making 75 grand, being able to buy a brand new house for 250 grand or over. And I mean, you can probably still buy an older house that needs a lot of work, but it's just one of those things that I think that that's just gone. And that's maybe something we haven't collectively reckoned with.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, like, I know like the American dream is homeownership, right? That's where we've grown up around. Maybe some of the millennials haven't grown up around, but you know that, but you know, if you've lived in other countries, like it's just not on the radar. You know, when I lived in India, it was not on the radar. Like either you were born into money and had an opportunity and you had real estate and people got pretty comfortable, like, oh, I'll never own anything. Are you kidding? Like, and they signed like a 5-year lease for their flat or whatever, right? Or even in European countries, you know, either you inherit it or you're not going to ever own. It's just not a priority. Do we think we're moving that way?
I don't, which is the weird, like I think that dream is still as alive and well as it ever has been. Maybe it's been pushed out 10 years. Like maybe you don't want to buy your first home at 25 or 30, maybe it's 35 or 40 now, but it's, I do think it's something we're going to, but it's also the politically challenging part is that like 75-80% of voters are homeowners. And so it's voters are going to vote for their own interests, especially at the local level. And so like I'm on the Brookhaven Planning Commission and, you know, everybody who votes in a Brookhaven election is a homeowner more or less. And so, you know, even if the right thing to do is to help out renters, there's no political impulse to do that. So it's just a really challenging problem.
Yeah. Our philosophy at our firm has been the way you create affordable housing is actually build it affordably, right? Keep costs down. You know, government has a role around, you know, taxes and land costs and different things that they can do to be a catalyst. But seeing where building materials prices go and, you know, how do you build things cheaper is what it comes down to. And so, if you build it cheaper, then you can sell it cheaper.
Something that I don't think people appreciate outside of the industry is the change in the housing industry since the Great Recession, where you've had so much consolidation throughout the supply chain. So whether it's lumber, windows, paint, you name it, the home builders, there are fewer and fewer people producing them and they carry less inventory. And so it just makes it a much, it's not like in 2005 where people were just building as much as they could. It's much more constrained all throughout the market. And they're just, there's no real way to build a lot of homes quickly, especially affordably.
Yeah.
And I don't see that changing because like, who's going to start a home builder these days?
Yeah. No, it's a really hard business. Yeah.
And the labor, of course, situation's changed a ton with immigration and whatnot.
Yeah. No, and we've seen a lot of startups focused on built to rent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which is interesting, you know, if we think build to rent was something that was a necessity that kind of came out of the Great Recession, where there was just a ton of inventory and people were buying up houses and renting them. And now you have entire business models focused on, oh, we're going to go buy a bunch of properties, or we're going to develop a brand new subdivision.
Right.
And it's going to be build to rent. And we're seeing a ton of private equity going into that space. And, you know, I don't see how you're, you know, they're just pushing up, taking up all the supply and pushing up the prices. So
yeah, my guess is in the markets with good demographics, in sort of your, let's say you're under $400,000 price point, probably like 30%, if not more, of activity will be build to rent going forward. They're just going to say, you know, let's pick these metro areas, which we like, let's pick this price point. We're going to just gobble up all that supply. And we'll even go to the builders directly and say, don't even bother selling them, build the community that we want, and we'll give you money for it.
Yeah.
So there's no way for an individual home buyer to do anything about that.
No, it is interesting. I mean, we see it in VC. Mm-hmm. Capital is such a weapon.
Right.
Right. Just having lots of capital, like a Blackstone or in our world, a Tiger Global shows up and just gives them a one pager in 3 mm-hmm. hours and, you know, doesn't really care. And it's like, how do you even compete with that?
Well, and even if you're a home, like we went to Disney World in May and one of my wife's college friends or high school friends is in real estate. And she said, if you need a mortgage, you're at a competitive disadvantage in this market. And so it's like, forget the down payment. It's like, unless you can pay cash, you're just out of luck if you need to buy a home for $300,000.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah. I went through that with my cabin. It was just like, if you need a mortgage, then
yeah,
you're not going to get anything. Like the minute something goes on the market, you're
right,
not gonna get it. You're competing with New York and Miami and Chicago. You better be willing to close in 14 days and have funds ready.
All cash, right.
All cash, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty interesting. What, I know one of the things that we kind of bounce around on Twitter is some of the urban dynamics of whether it's, you know, back to David's thing about the, about equity and the continued disparity, but, you know, Atlanta is a good example of like gentrification and, you know, people are now, I read something a long time ago that said the, you know, a good community is one where the people that work there can actually afford to live there. So the person bussing tables doesn't have to drive from so far. And I think the dynamic we're having in Atlanta is really not too different than any other city in America. I mean, I think we're both in Atlanta, so we're like, oh my gosh, crime is up. Oh my God, you know. And then you talk to your friends in Chicago, like, oh my gosh, crime is up. You know, it's mm-hmm. not necessarily unique. How do we see some of that? I mean, do you have an opinion on how some of that starts to pan out and how that starts to factor into like the need for mass transit, especially cities like Atlanta that have been slow to adopt?
Yeah, it's a different conversation now, I think, than it was 2 years ago, because transit ridership throughout the country is down so much. Like the New York City subway is still 40% of pre-pandemic demand. And so I think like, I doubt, and this is going to make me unpopular, I don't think heavy rail is going to really be built anywhere in the country going forward. So it's really about what can you do with buses, maybe, you know, passenger commuter rail type stuff. But I think, you know, maybe MARTA gets one Gwinnett station as a terminal, but you know, people who are hoping that we just build rail everywhere, I think are going to be pretty disappointed.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's, especially with remote work, it's like, all right, you know, it used to be, well, you build MARTA out to Gwinnett and then you can take MARTA in 5 days a week. And now it's like, I'll just work remotely and come in at 11 a.m. twice a week. So it's sort of, we're going to change culture rather than building infrastructure.
Yeah. I think we're going to start wrapping up. So if anyone has questions, go ahead and shoot them now while we start to wrap up. One of the things that came up the other day was around like gig economy stuff, you know, this idea that And I would say the few people I've talked to, they're the second income. They either got laid off, quit their job, hated their boss. Their boss was like, no, I can't have you be remote. I need to see what you're doing. Like, which creates all these like trust questions. Right. But like, you know, I'm just going to work when I want to. I'm going to drive for Uber, do Instacart, whatever, and make a good living. And work is just a means to make money. Like, I'm not looking for a career path. And I just wonder, like, what happens 5 years from now when you decide you want a career? And you know, the person I talked to was like a loan officer at a bank, and her boss basically said, no, you got to be in the office. Like, you got to be here and work on loans. And she's like, I'm out. And now she's part-time Instacart, whatever, whatever. Whenever she needs money, she turns it up. She flips on DoorDash whenever she needs money. And, you know, so my question was just like, what are you going to do when, you know, is this like you're giving up your career?
Right.
And like,
I think it's sort of, will this labor market that, you know, to you and I is very unusual, will this be kind of a new normal? Will it actually be easy to get a job? Like, I vaguely remember stories in the 90s of it being easy for a few years, and it hasn't been for 20. And so I think it's easy. I think I could see it for like the gig economy path of like, maybe this should be the way it works. Maybe it should be, you just turn on DoorDash and you can make money whenever you want. But yeah, for your traditional career path, white collar, if you step out of that, is stepping back in easy? And I guess to some extent, it's like, will the labor market still be pretty tight?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's just wild because I feel like you're basically saying I'm opting, because 5 years from now, after you've been gigging, you know, doing the gig economy, you're not going to go back to the bank. Like, you're going to be unemployable, maybe, right?
I don't know. Right.
Yeah. So David asked this question, ton of dry powder in both VC and PE. How will this change the game? Which I think is a general liquidity. We can keep talking about. There's so much.
Yeah. I feel like I've always heard that throughout my career. So I don't know if that's any different. I mean, outside of the 2008 recession, which that's not going to happen. I mean, it's sort of like if people who are working remember a crisis, we're not going to repeat that crisis. So I think, like, you know, even for you and I, like, it's not going to happen again in our career. So it's like, you know, there's no point. But ever since then, you've had these quick, sharp crashes. Like in 2018, there was a quick one in Q4 of the pandemic, but it happened so quickly that there's not enough time for your big sleepy piles of cash to really deploy it. And so maybe that means that we won't have that kind of deep recession that people can, you know, put a lot of money to work in and make a lot of money. But that there's a lot of money on the sidelines. We've been hearing it for 10 years, and maybe that's changed things. Maybe it hasn't, but it just seems like it's just there, and I don't know what they do with it.
Yeah. I mean, I do think there is a, you know, in the world of VC, you know, you look at valuations and a lot of that stuff, and you say, well, you know, valuations are through the roof or whatever. We're much more fundamentalist in terms of, we actually do math to come up with some concept of what a valuation is. But, you know, when you see tech companies, the public tech companies having a couple of bad days and people saying, you know, how is XYZ trading at, you know, 70 times earnings, or, I think Nick on my team posted something just now in the chat about just do whatever, the opposite, I think, of what Jim Cramer tells you on CNBC or so, something to that effect. You know, of course, Jim Cramer is on there saying, oh my gosh, like, if a company can't make money at tech, then why, you know, how are they getting these valuations? And that does trickle down, because, you know, people do start to look at comps against what Salesforce and Microsoft.
Yeah.
And,
or if you're an IPO and the IPO comps aren't good, then that impacts private valuations. And yeah.
Well, and I think also, I mean, like, bringing up IPOs as well, I think, you know, how many of the IPOs that happened last year are above their IPO price?
It's, yeah. Like, even briefly, low. Like, Rivian went below its IPO price today. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah, last year was definitely unusual with SPACs and the meme stocks, and, you know, that seems to have been unusual. But so I think we probably won't go back to those conditions, but it's probably still historically strong, even if we're not back to that.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Like, you bring up SPACs. I did a SPAC when I was 28, and I never talk about it because it's shady.
Yeah. Well, I'm just, it's funny you say that, because like I'm just now getting to the point where things I saw earlier in my career and are coming back. I'm like, wait, don't people remember that? And it's like, no, they don't, because they're 27 and they weren't there for it. It's like, oh, I'm getting old. All right. Not cool.
Of course, we have like last minute questions. Catherine, has a major correction come up for you guys in the rule set? I don't know. I think the question is, do we see a major bust in real estate in the stock market coming up?
I don't think so.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, our generation, like we saw the way the baby boomers ran the economy of like constantly letting these big crashes happen. And last year was like, we're not going to let that happen anymore. So we just pump money at it. We used to do it with interest rates, but now we're doing it with government spending as well. And yeah. I think if anything, the risk is the other side of, you know, people are like, oh, well, even if there's a recession, we'll just spend $3 trillion and plug the hole. So we don't really need to worry about anything. And it's the risk on the other side is probably what's growing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think within my friend group, it's always like, sell your, you know, book a profit and then do what?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, put it so buy bonds at 2%.
No, like, so if I already have a stock I love and it's running, I'm going to book a profit and do what? Put it into a stock that I maybe don't care about, put it into buy. Like, it's just, there's nowhere, if you're going to chase yield, even if you're not trying to chase crazy yield, like I just want to chase like 5% and 7%. It's still like,
yeah,
you know, you're going to still stay in the equities market.
I mean, part of this is the inequality thing, but if you had money going into the pandemic, you're probably now a lot better off than you were before. And so you're like, wow, I've had a pandemic and I'm richer than I've ever been before. So what does that do to your psychology down the road?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. Eric Adams, the new mayor of New York, gave a little talk this morning. You know, and he's been, got to take care of the dishwashers. And and he's right. I mean, he's not, and especially in a market like New York, where there is a lot of wealth. And you look at the great resume, you look at all these narratives, and he's just saying, like, you guys are missing this entire population that is still struggling.
Right.
To pay their bills. And I think it's like 1 million people haven't been able to pay their rent, and that's still existing. And unfortunately, you know, I don't know what the answer is. I don't know that a lot of people have that answer. So our friend Christopher Cunney asked a question. What are some of the emerging markets you're looking to make investments in this year?
Emerging markets, meaning countries, or what exactly does that mean?
I don't know. Christopher, if you want to clarify, let's talk about countries. I'm scared shitless about other countries. Like, I feel like I can't figure out my own country. Like,
I briefly,
Brazil, like, or Argentina, or like.
Like last summer, US tech stocks had taken off and China stocks had sold off. And I was like, oh, like, good time to buy Alibaba. And then they're like, no, Americans don't get to make money in our stocks anymore. It's like, all right, well, forget that. So it's, I think that's the risk in other countries. It's like, you look at the valuations, you're like, this is cheap. And then the government says, foreigners don't get to keep their money. It's like, oh, they're not cheap. So that's the one thing about America, is that we, for better or worse, we prioritize investors over everything else.
Yeah, so Christopher came back and said technology services, et cetera. So I'm still not exactly sure. I mean, I think, look, I do think what's interesting about venture, which I've been doing it for a minute, is that there's actually venture capital going towards businesses that you would have never seen before, mm-hmm. whether it be consumer goods, non-tech. You know, if you kind of, my generation, VC meant tech. They were the same thing. You know, tech investors, venture investors were the same thing. You're now starting to see a lot of VC that's going towards services businesses, which has never been heard of. You're seeing a lot of venture debt saying like, hey, it's not about equity. I'm going to loan you money and have some upside. And then I thought it was really interesting, Sequoia with their latest Evergreen fund saying, we're not really going to look for an exit when Uber goes public or whatever. We're just going to hold on.
Interesting.
It's an interesting stat. I think Sequoia, you know, they were early in Google. They basically say if they would have just held on to Google, they would have had top quartile returns in their fund. You know, so like, why are we selling out of Google or Microsoft or all these companies? We'll just put them in our Evergreen fund and hold them forever. And since they're public, we can give liquidity. If investors need their money out, they get it out. But
I think in the public markets, anything that, I mean, and I'm not saying, I mean, I'll point out Peloton. I don't know Peloton. I'm not saying I like it, but something like that where it had this big demand surge due to the pandemic, and then maybe it kind of pulled forward too much demand, and so it's had some rough quarters. That sort of dynamic is interesting to me because people are looking at the past few rough quarters rather than like a 2-year trend where maybe it's fine. It just 2020 was too good and 2021 was bad. So that sort of dynamic is one worth looking at, I think, in public tech.
Yeah, I think a lot on the public side, I've been looking at kind of spread plays. Like, you know, it's like, you know, is Microsoft going to beat Google or is Facebook, you know, just like pick two and kind of decide like one's going to do better than the other. Like, let's play a spread and see what happens. But it definitely, and I do think, to your point, you've been through a couple cycles. I have. People just don't remember, you know, that people's memories are just so short when it comes to this. And I remember during the .com, I'd be at dinner parties and everybody's like, oh, I'm up X percent. It's like, yeah, you can throw a dart at the market and you're up X percent, you know, and then.
And I think people, and then what happened? You know, people always hate whatever cycle you're in. And that's something I didn't appreciate early on. Like, cause I came out of college in the mid 2000s and then it was like, people hated the housing bubble. They were like subprime and this, it's unsustainable. And then I remember like when LinkedIn went public in 2011, it's like, are we in another tech bubble? And that was like a big thing. It's like LinkedIn doubling in price on day one in 2011. And so, you know, and then last year, it's like, why is the stock market going up when, you know, New York City shut locked down, quote unquote. And so people are just always negative and you have to kind of try to make sense of what's going on and not buy into that negativity.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah. Well, that's a good spot to say goodbye. Thanks for being on, man. This is great. Yeah. I think, we try to, we're in this interesting world of like our community is startups, angel investors, and then these big corporates. And as a real estate and construction, you know, real estate industry has lots of data and, you know, and, but you know, some of our folks are in construction. I really try to do these in a way to give people a different, you know, to not end up being myopic. I think next month or the month after, I have a friend who's like a music producer that I'm going to have on just to like, you know, hey, what's happening with music and NFTs in that world and, you know, rights and what's happening with streaming. Cause I think if we get stuck in our own industry about, oh, it's, we're being disrupted. It's like, yes, you and everyone else.
Right.
So thanks for coming on. I just like having different perspectives for our little community and really appreciate you showing up.
Yeah. Thanks for inviting me.
All right. Thanks.
Great talking. All right. Yeah.